Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. I mean, days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
What better topic for a podcast than hearing enlightenment, particularly a meditation podcast? Well, that is today's topic. This was a talk given by David Perrin, a regular contributor to the podcast, back in early October, called Hearing Enlightenment. What does that mean? What does enlightenment have to do with our sense perceptions? Sometimes when I'm on the subway, I think I'm smelling enlightenment, but that could be something else. But before we get to this talk, this is a good talk, so I'm glad you're here. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that Shastri Ethan Nickturn, another regular contributor to the podcast, senior teacher in the Shambhala, New York community, he is giving a evening of teachings called Learn to Work with Difficult People, Holiday Edition. This is on the evening of Wednesday, November 30th at 6:30. This three-hour workshop is available to you to prepare yourself, should you need such preparation, for working with difficult people over the holiday season. Perhaps you may experience encounters with difficult people, or at least difficult encounters with people over the month of December and beyond. Well, this is a great evening of teachings, meditation instructions, and group exploration and exploration with Shastri Ethan Nickturn about working with difficult people. For more information and to register, go to ny.shambhala.org, go to classes and programs, and go to Learn to Work with Difficult People, November 30th. And now, David Perrin, he is a meditation instructor, teacher, therapist, father, husband, superhero. He has a question for you.
If you were to choose whether you would like to become enlightened in this lifetime or not, how many of you would choose to become enlightened? Okay, thank you. So, Not everybody raised their hand, which is I respect. It's a daunting question, right? It's a daunting proposition. And I remember early on when I was starting to meditate, there would be certain teachers that would be very direct about this question. They would say, "Well, you know, are you here to become enlightened? Like, are you doing? Do you sit on this cushion because that's your objective?" And I would sort of think, "Well, I just, you know, I want to have a better day tomorrow. Like, I want to be a little friendlier, maybe like a little bit more chilled out, get some clarity. Like, what am I supposed to do for work? Who's going to be my partner? Like, let's start with the basics before we get to enlightenment." But they say, you know, particularly the Buddhist teachers who come out of cultures where talking about enlightenment is, it's more of a frank conversation. And we don't always actually invoke the idea of, is that our aspiration to become enlightened? So I want to talk about enlightenment tonight. And I want to talk about it not from the point of view of like the socio-political movement, the age of reason, science, rationalism, demystification of all sorts of concepts, right? Like in the 17th and 18th century, this was a very important series of events, frameworks, philosophy that in some ways we're still living, right? We're still living in that age. And often meditation is taught from that perspective of science and reason. It's very valuable. So that's kind of one end of the spectrum of enlightenment, and then the other end of the spectrum is this idea of more of like a spiritual quest, something that can kind of be considered more mystical, more esoteric, that we're transcending, you know, this mortal coil, this worldly life that we live, and we're connecting to a higher principle, higher being, perhaps. So these are two notions of enlightenment, right, that people are familiar with. So the enlightenment I want to talk about tonight is actually very visceral. It's very here and right now, and it has to do with the senses. So I want us to think about enlightenment as illumination. So literally, as if you were to walk into a room that you hadn't been in years, and the quality of switching on the light switch. When you walk in that room, you might see shadows, you might not see much of anything, and then when you switch on the light, it happens like that. It's not a huge, switching on the light is not this huge buildup. You walk in the room and you turn on the light, whether it's been years since you've been in that room or just recently. So do you have that feeling of like how just instantaneous that can be? Okay, so let's back up a second. So bear with me on this question. This might not seem like a question for many savvy New Yorkers who are, I'm sure, well-established and well along in their careers. And what are the five senses? Touch, taste, sight, hearing, and smell. Okay. Did that feel like I was asking a room of first graders a question? What's interesting is this beginning to correlate this notion of enlightenment as a first grade question. It's we take for our senses for granted, and we don't think on that, at least I don't, think on that basic level of when I sit down to eat a meal, just like we were attempting to do with our peaceful abiding practice, that I would actually be in accord with or attuned to each bite of the meal that I'm tasting. Or if I was to see a cloud formation in the sky, so I have three children, and like when they look up at the sky, they actually see pigs and dragons and fairies. And partly because that child mind, we often hear about that child mind as on the path of a meditator, it's like that child mind, it's fresh, right? It's that fresh mind, and we come with our jaded, you know, covered over, obscured, and we're just trying to get to the subway or wherever it is. And we don't stop and actually experience our senses, whereas to a child, it's very magical. Although, do any of you have the experience that as you sit on the cushion, that's part of what's being reawakened? Right? That we're reconnecting to our senses in a way that maybe we haven't been since we were children? So I want to talk a little bit specifically. So let's choose one for tonight. I already chose one. You don't get to choose. We're going to choose the sense of hearing. So let's linger a little bit on this quality of what is sound. My brother is an eco-psychology professor at Lesley University in Boston, and he recently told me, recommended a book called the Great Animal Orchestra. Has anyone read this book? The Great Animal Orchestra was written by Bernie Krause, and it's a couple years old now. And Bernie Krause is a naturalist and a musician. So he started out as a professional musician and played with some world-renowned groups. And then he kind of morphed into this like sound production career where he was producing for movie soundtracks, et cetera. And at one point, he got an assignment to record some nature sounds and to incorporate that into the score of some sort of video or a movie production. And he went out and he turned on his microphone, and it was like one of these life moments where he was just blown away and he knew what he was going to do for the rest of his life, which was basically travel around the world and record these soundscapes. So soundscapes are, it's just as you imagine, when you go into a particular environment, it's all the different sounds that are made or that we receive in one, you could say, one sitting. And he became, because previous to his career, a lot of people who went into nature, they would just record like one bird or an elk or something. And he became really interested in actually the whole biophony. He called it the biophony. So that was like the totality of what the sounds that that ecosystem were making. And he found that actually he could begin to measure the health of an ecosystem based on the kind of the diversity and the richness of the sound that was being produced by all the animals, insects included, and that even the slightest disturbance like airplane traffic, of course, habitat change or destruction, humans intervening almost in any way would change the biophony of that particular ecosystem. And sometimes it would take it years to recover. So whereas before, and the idea of the orchestra was that he could hear sound at all these, the animals are almost like, it was as if they're coordinating with each other, because they're occupying different pieces of the spectrum in terms of how loud they are or what their frequency is, so as not to directly compete with one another, because them producing sound is a livelihood for them in terms of mating, finding food, etc. So it was like this orchestra that seemed to be coordinated. So what is sound? You just yell it out.
Vibration.
And where? And it, someone said air. Who said air? Air. Okay. So why air?
You can't hear in outer space without air.
You can't hear.
The vibration can't travel in nothing.
Interesting. So the vibration has to travel through air. Can also travel through
water
or even solids. But the thing about sound is that it's kind of an enigma, right? It's we can't see it. We can't touch it. We can't taste it. So some people have described sound as actually like this shadow sense. It's very ethereal. It's like amorphous, and it feels like it's all pervasive because there's air all around us, right? So there's sometimes we don't know which way a sound is. I grew up in the suburbs, and one of the, you know how sometimes we have sounds, it can also be tastes or smells that are very nostalgic. One of the very nostalgic sounds for me is to hear an airplane go across the sky. What's that effect? Is it the Doppler effect?
Yeah.
Where you can, the way you hear it go from one point to the next. So we've already talked about some of the different attributes of sound, right? Frequency, which is basically what? Right, the rate at which the air vibrates. So if it vibrates very fast, you have a high pitch, and low, you have a low pitch. Amplitude, which is the loudness. And then Bernie Krause mentions two other. Do you want to guess at those of you who are kind of nerds with this stuff? What's that?
Wavelength
is, yeah, that's frequency. That would be under frequency.
Presence
of overtones, which would begin to, so that would probably fit into the timbre of it. Timbre. timber. And then the fourth one is envelope. So like the overall kind of as it travels, as it moves, what's the sort of shape of the sound? Okay, so this is a baseline of sound. So what does this have to do with meditation? Well, one of the things that Bernie Krause says that's very interesting to me is he says that he realized when he went out to record in nature and he had these really sensitive microphones that the microphones would pick up all the different sounds indiscriminately, right? A microphone is not showing preference to one sound or another. It's capturing everything. And sometimes when he would be in certain places, he would move the mic around so he could really get the panorama of all the different sounds in the soundscape. And it dawned on him that actually his own ear, he had been using his own ear more as a gate than as a portal. And I don't know about you, but living in this town, my ears are definitely gates. I'm using my ears more to keep things out than I am to let them in. Does anyone else have that experience? So we have to begin to ask, well, what does that mean in terms of our being meditators? Because it's really nice to come into this beautiful space that's fairly quiet. Although earlier this evening we were talking and Leslie was saying that now that we've shut the windows, it's so quiet in here that it actually is like a little intense. But what does it mean? What is our relationship? Because in Shambhala, what's so important in this body of teachings is to talk about our relationship between out there and in here. So we come here for refuge. We come here to work with our minds. But what happens at 11:30 tonight when we leave here and we go back home and we're against our better judgment, we start looking at the headlines to see who won the debate? Maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's when on the train we're overhearing other people have already checked their phones or who watched the debate and trying to hear what did they say about it. The point is that we are really looking at how our practice on the cushion affects our lives out in the world. Because if this doesn't affect our lives out in the world, this is nice to do. But there's other cool hobbies, like we could all go out and play pool or... has anyone heard the name? I want to tell a little story. I like telling stories. Have you heard the name Avalokiteshvara? Avalokiteshvara is also known as Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin is the Chinese version of the name Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin, and I'm going to use the pronoun they because it's not necessarily clear whether this is a female or male. This is like a saint or a revered teacher in the Buddhist tradition. So at one point in the Buddhist sutras, which are the teachings of the Buddha, right? The Buddhist teachings were not written down when the Buddha gave those teachings. They were written down subsequently. And then these teachings traveled, they migrated. And for China, it was along the Silk Road. So specifically, this comes out of the Chinese canon of the Buddhist sutras, and it's called the Surangama Sutra. And in this sutra, Avalokiteshvara Kuan Yin gives the story of how they woke up, became enlightened. You want to hear it? So this teacher, this being, would meditate by the ocean. And they said that when they meditated by the ocean, of course they would hear the surf and the tide coming in and out. Now, that's for most of us, like, that's something that we have on a setting on our sound machines, right? It's nice and peaceful. Well, if you've spent a lot of time by the ocean, at some point it becomes pretty intense because it doesn't stop, and sometimes the roar of that surf, depending on how close you are, can be loud. So just tuning into that, right? Tuning into that, sitting there for hours and hours just listening. Just like Bernie Krause would go out and listen in nature and imagine that Avalokiteshvara is like this super sensitive microphone. That's the way they consider themselves. A super sensitive microphone picking up mostly the surf, but then beginning to pay attention and asking the question, what's actually going on here? And deciding roughly that there's three different phenomena. There's three different aspects to hearing. Anyone have a guess as to what these three things are? Perception. Okay, so say more about perception. What does it take to perceive? It takes a consciousness, a conscious awareness, so that's one. Takes the ability. That's actually sometimes talked about as like the fourth, is like our innate ability to hear. So we have our consciousness, but then we have our ability. So let's say that's the fourth. So we need two more.
Knowledge.
Let's put knowledge and understanding under the category of conscious awareness for now. The two are really simple, they're really basic. There's a source. Okay, good. So there's a source. So there's a resonator, something that's reverberating or resonating and sending the sound waves. And the last one?
Receiver.
There's a receiver, which is what? Yeah. So pretty basic, right? In a way. But again, it's like that conversation we were having in the beginning. This is not something that most of us think about all the time. But what Avalokiteshvara basically did to become enlightened was that they truly used the ear as a portal, went into the consciousness, the audio consciousness, completely relaxed there, and relaxing, when I say completely relaxing, I mean indiscriminately. I mean like the super sensitive microphone quality. Not making judgments about this, that, or the other. Allowing everything in. And almost in a sense, like you could say, dropping any kind of labels of what they were actually hearing. You want to try it? All right, so however you're comfortable sitting, you can sit however. And if it helps to close your eyes, you can certainly close your eyes. So indiscriminate listening. Includes the sound of my voice. You may notice how easily it comes to us to selectively listen. So for example, if you're listening to the sound of my voice right now and prioritizing that over another sound, this is what happens all the time. And so subtly or not, we choose certain sounds and we disregard others. So if we have the mic, I'd be curious to hear people's thoughts and reflections on doing that.
So I felt like that experience is kind of like how we try to control things in our life in order to make sense of it. It's kind of how I felt like the relationship was in the sound exercise, where the reason I found myself focusing on one or the other is because I was in my mind trying to make sense of what I was interpreting. And the more I tried to expand it, the more it felt like trying to let go of control. Mm. And also being slightly overwhelmed by not being able, if you let that go, then everything's just happening to you. Mm. So that was my experience with it.
What's the, can you say a little bit more about the overwhelming quality of that?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like you're being subjected to the sound.
Uh-huh.
And kind of like when you're in New York City, you feel like you're being bombarded in a certain way, especially if you're coming back from a trip where you're in nature and then all of a sudden you're in Times Square and it's like, you know, the sirens are going, the horns are honking. And so, yes, it feels over. I felt like when I tried to not focus on one, that you get a small sense of that anxiety of other things coming in at you.
Yeah, really interesting that, right, anxiety and the anxiety that it brings up to not filter.
Yeah.
Was that, did anyone else have that experience? Please, thank you. That's great.
Well, first, I could hear mostly the fan and you, and I was listening for other sounds, but I felt like I was actively listening, like hoping something else would happen. I would hear something else, and I didn't. And then it was just like meditation. My mind started to take over.
Uh-huh.
And I started thinking. And then I thought, oh, is that a sound? Is my thinking a sound? And I started to feel that it was.
Yeah. Why did you think that it was?
Because it was like an inner voice.
Uh-huh.
It was the same as an outer voice, except no one else could hear it.
Yes. Well, I could hear what you're thinking, but no. So what's interesting, if we think about this very basic breakdown of the ear, the resonator, and the audio consciousness, you know, there's been research that's been done on the brain that I'm not familiar with other than just having read it, which is that when they stimulate certain parts of the brain, people feel like they hear sounds. So this idea of the audio consciousness being an important part of just even the idea of what is sound, and that without it, and that maybe, you know, maybe it's true, you don't need the resonator or the ear to have an experience of sound.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. Thank you.
I did my level 2 recently, and the windows were open, and there were 2 and at times 3 jackhammers going. Throughout the day, and I'm really not in favor of the concept of letting go of sound and just being really neutral towards it, because I was really delighted by the jackhammers, and every time, I'm sort of strange, and I would breathe out in that dissolution of self and boundaries, and that sort of disintegrating and having a larger sense of self was really driven by audio. And every time there was a honk in the distance, I was like, yes, like it's so far away and I'm that far away from, you know, just like pushing out and realizing I'm in this body, I'm in this room, I'm in this city, I'm on this earth. So I really like the sense of sound to draw me out, and so I kind of felt sad when we had to practice being neutral to it all.
Well, so it's interesting because I'm hearing you say is actually the same thing as what I was talking about, which is I mean, there's a certain appreciation that you have for sounds, right? And there was an appreciation for the jackhammer, there's an appreciation for the honk. If someone was having an argument, that might be like, thank God that's not me having that argument. You're like, you know, I mean, whatever. It's kind of dimensionalizing your experience and realizing that there's a bigger experience than just what I'm churning up in my mind.
Yes, it would help me catch myself.
Yeah.
If I was lost in my thought and there would be a honk, I would, awaken the
it's
world.
It's a reminder to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that I don't think it's so much different than that.
Okay.
I think, though, that, so if we're using the sounds to want to have a certain experience, then that just means that at another point when there's not sound, we might be like, oh, darn it. I can't have that experience because there are not sounds.
Yes, when you mentioned the silence that Leslie had mentioned, I thought, it is too quiet.
Right. So that's where, so on the one hand, I think that what you're saying about like appreciating all the different sounds is wonderful, and you're allowing them all in. So that's an open portal, right?
Yeah.
But then there, on another hand, there is still kind of like you're hoping for certain sounds to happen, so that if they don't happen, then that's like almost automatically, you know, ruins our experience, or we can't get back to where we were.
Yeah.
So the idea is that the appreciation is, you know, what we talk about in terms of the senses is that the appreciation is in and of itself. It's not dependent on any one particular sound, one particular meal that we have, one particular breath that we feel, one particular scent. You know, if we walked around feeling like we always wanted things to smell nice, we would have to live near like Bond number 9 or something, you know, like a perfume place. Yeah. You know, so but what we're practicing and training in is like not necessarily needing the world to be a certain way and still cultivating that appreciation. Mm. Does that make sense?
Very helpful. Thank
you.
Yeah,
okay.
I had the experience when I was listening of hearing the fan and the hum of the speaker, and then finding myself labeling that fan. Oh, that's a fan noise, and then not listening to it anymore, knowing what it was. And then I noticed, and I would listen to it again, and I would kind of notice the texture of it. And then I, you know, a few seconds later, oh, that's a fan. I don't have to think about it anymore. And that kind of controlling and labeling kind of coming hand in hand, and part of the opening up was looking for the texture and being a little bit more sensitive to it.
Sensitive to it. So that's sort of the opening the gate and then like imagining the sensitivity of the consciousness, that the consciousness actually is picking up a lot of information about even just the whirring of a fan, even the hum of the microphone and the speakers. Right, there's a lot of texture, there are a lot of things going on there, but we filter that down to something that's very specific. And exactly as you're saying, and you know, so what do you think that has to do with the, we bring back the sense of light and sound. No, I'm gonna have him, you can keep the mic. Yes. Illumination, so what is the correlation between illumination and what you're talking about?
If we were to compare it to something more cinematic, the labeled fan is almost like a word on a page, and the listening to it is real. It's alive. It's I don't know. So the illumination is like the real thing with all the details, with all the things on the floor as they are. I don't know, like the wallpaper, you forgot what it was like, but now you see it.
Yeah. So can we say that that's a moment of enlightenment?
Yeah, if under this definition, I guess.
Okay. Thank you.
I actually have a question.
Yeah.
So if you're equating enlightenment with the sense of indiscriminately listening to the sounds, when you're amongst a cacophony of sound, like in New York City, and the way that it can assault your senses, how do you deal with that kind of visceral reaction of being overwhelmed? Yeah,
it's a good question, right? Because this idea of like, how do we achieve enlightenment living here in New York? And many of us have this a little bit fantasy, I know I do, that if I could go out to somewhere quiet in the woods where I love to be and like that's where I could live, that I would get more in touch with this enlightened state of being. And also feeling often very bombarded and assaulted. But my hunch is, and living in New York and not living out there, my hunch is that that feeling of being bombarded and assaulted can happen. We were talking earlier, like, what about the sounds we can't hear that are in our head? That same quality of being bombarded, and when I have been on longer meditation retreats, I have this experience that there could it could be totally quiet, bird songs, totally peaceful, but I have the same feeling, which is that I'm bombarded by my own experience. So, you know, it could be memories, it could be fear, anxiety, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not doing a good enough job raising my kids, I'm not in the right job, you know, that talk that I gave whenever was like crap. Whatever the judgment is that comes in is that same quality of bombardment. So I think this is a path not so much of changing our thought patterns or changing the external environment, but it's actually sitting in that for a second and noticing how it makes us feel. So it's illuminating the experience of being completely bombarded. And sometimes we can't stand in the middle of Times Square to do that. Sometimes we need to actually sit in a coffee shop and not have any other agenda but just to have a nice drink that we like to have, like give ourselves something nice, and just listen. Or be on the subway platform and not be waiting for the next train, but actually just listen to the sounds in the environment. I tell stories to my kids that's like the underground world of what we call the Nagas, which are like these underground creatures. And the trains are these Nagas that are running through the system. And, you know, you can hear them. You can hear the screeches far off in the distance. You know, you can hear people chattering and you imagine people anticipating. Like, it can be a whole story and it can be very cinematic. And then what's bombardment? We can begin to transform into like the movie of our lives. It's sometimes fun to be in New York and imagine you're the star of your own movie and someone's filming you, right? And so that that sensitivity is kind of used to not feed the habitual storyline and not feed the feeling of like, I'm trying to protect myself because this place is just, you know, I'm getting hit from every angle. We certainly need to have awareness and have some sense of protection. I'm not saying go out into the subway platform and just close your eyes and, you know, you have to be alert. But within that alertness, we can feel, oh, I'm feeling uneasy right now. I'm feeling scared. And that's it. Just noticing that.
I just have a question. You said that you donate the ears to listen. Can that be a form of telepathy, I think it's pronounced?
Telepathy?
Yes, when you talk like mind to mind without sound.
Yeah, I don't have any experience with that. But I think we're talking about the audio consciousness and that it's very sensitive and complex. But we're using actual sounds in the environment to relate more to that consciousness.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. This
gentleman here has a question.
So the relationship that I had with this, I had my own experience with visuals maybe 6 or 7 months ago, where I decided to just power through it and get to the point of enlightenment, of just being present. And since then, it's been exciting because you're basically stoned all the time. Mm. Like everywhere you go, you can just look, because again, I was using visuals, and you can look around and you can stand on a street corner and holy shit, this place is amazing,
right?
Because you can be with it and you can separate yourself and detach yourself. But just to kind of throw in something based off some of the other things that people had said, one of the experiments that I started playing, I try to do experiments like once a week or once every 2 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. So this weekend I decided to go camping in New York. Mm-hmm. What that meant is I decided to be homeless for a weekend. Mm-hmm. And I could be home, or I could go Airbnb or couch surf or do whatever the hell I wanted. I can always release. This is different than someone who's actually homeless and can't get out of there. But people, the thing that's kind of funny is I feel like people try to, like, they're holding on so tight, like, oh, I'm going to have my life and my experience, but by popping out and saying, like, okay, rather than saying the city is attacking me, the city's not attacking anybody, it's not assaulting anybody, the city's just citying itself. It's just being, and we're just present in it. But by going out there and stepping out of my own comfort zone and sleeping on a train, sleeping on the Staten Island Ferry, I ended up sleeping at JFK, which is an amazing place to sleep because you don't feel awkward because a lot of tourists are doing it too, or a lot of travelers. But by having that experience, anything that was coming into my world, I could release myself of having to be myself and, okay, well, I'm Michael Donovan. I'm a photographer. I do this. I do that. I was able to just be and leave it and just, it's kind of like what you're saying. It's like I was out in the wild. I was out in this, you know, in the biosphere of New York. So I think, I don't know, I guess the thing is that by having this experience in here, when there's nothing, it's amazing. When there's something, it's amazing. And I think that's the thing that we all, like at least I sometimes will forget, that the purpose of all of this is really just to be a kid. And when you're a kid, the world's fucking amazing. Yeah. And so if it's silent and all that you hear is just somebody clicking their pen, that could be annoying. But if it's like, if you just chill down and say, wait a minute, holy shit, somebody made this plastic thing that makes a clicky noise and it ended up in this hand of some person that I don't even know who the hell it is, and I can say that they're a jackass for clicking this, or I could be like, wow, that's amazing. So just to kind of play with this all.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to look for you next time I go to JFK.
I realize how often my judgment call comes in, that I make decision. Is this now important or is it not? What if I make the wrong call? I'm going to miss so much. For instance, I was just in the subway when I came here, and there was a person asking for money in a very loud voice that I almost felt I had to hold on tight to, because it was a piercing voice that I felt would go right through my skull into my something. And that was a clear, you know, I didn't want to hear this. There was a guilt there, because I couldn't help her, or wouldn't want to help her, or whatever it is. Other moments, like in the exercise here, this is a room that feels very safe. I can identify where the sounds come from. It's good. Or I sit in a concert where it is wonderful to distinguish and to listen very carefully and to really make sure you don't miss anything. But how often do I not want to listen? Listen, if somebody tells me something that I have heard before and say, yeah, give me a break now, I don't want to hear it. And I think I miss a lot in my life.
I think that's
because
true. I think we all do.
It has become habitual.
Yes. That our lives have, okay, so thank you. Yeah, that's it. Our lives have become habitual, both what you're saying and Michael's saying relate, and in some sense what everyone's saying, is that we have become habituated to certain patterns, and so we've narrowed the scope of our existence drastically. And so that's why I said enlightenment, if we consider it as just illumination, just purely opening up the gate a little bit, we don't all have to, if we think of it as something where we're going to be on another plane of existence, as opposed to in each moment we have the opportunity to open up to our experience, and to feel the just annoyance or guilt or just the pain of why do we live in a world where someone has to scream at us to be seen or to receive what they need. You know, just that basic, like there's pain on so many different levels. And so if we can begin to open up to a little bit more of that, both the pain and the beauty and the majesty of the world. So what I wanted to share is that, you know, in the ascetic Buddhist tradition, right, in the Buddhist time, and when he created a monastic world, he created what's called the Vinaya, the Vinaya, which is the monastic code. It was the code of conduct, because basically that was a response to the fact that the senses are very powerful. This innate capacity that we have to sense the world is extremely powerful. So powerful that basically there was this whole set of rules and regulations on what you could do and couldn't do. And a lot of that, in my understanding, was to protect people from opening up the gate, allowing things in, and then pushing certain experiences away, grabbing onto other experiences, and creating a habitual relationship to the world based on just like, it's too much, or I want more of that. That's all through the gate of the senses. Now, are there any monks here or nuns? No, none of us are monks or nuns. Most of us will never be a monk or a nun. So in Shambhala, what you've walked into a space where the teachings, instead of saying we're going to cut ourselves off and we're going to make limitations and we're going to wear robes and shave our head, it's basically saying we are going to celebrate the senses. We're going to almost, it's almost as if there's this quality of venerating the senses, seeing the power of the senses and going fully into them as much as we can, like it's the most delicious thing you've ever tasted. So feeling presence, feeling your breath, feeling grounded, being in a place that feels relatively safe, and then just opening yourself up fully to one bite of food or to one delicious sound. That's the path that we cultivate as worldly practitioners that are on this path to enlightenment. We're not reducing, we're going into more fully. And so that's okay. You should have permission, and please do think that that's a possibility, that you don't have to go off into the mountains or the woods and live in a cabin by yourself to achieve the same experience that Avalokiteshvara achieved. It's possible. You all can do it because you all have these sensory capabilities. To whatever degree you have your five senses, you have the most powerful tools for enlightenment already, right now. No teacher is going to give you more than that. No experience is going to, all of a sudden I'm going to get something more than what the power that you already have with your own mind, your own consciousness, and your own ability to see, hear, taste, touch, and smell. So on that note, back to life. We do have some things to taste in the other room, so please enjoy some taste. Feel free to stay and hang out if you'd like. And thank you for coming tonight, and hope to see you around.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you for listening. Visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. If you happen to live in a different city, of course, there's maybe, possibly, probably, a Shambhala Meditation Center near you where you can experience meditation instruction and training in person. Of course, you can always listen to this podcast. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Tell your friends. Visit us if you are in the New York City area, where you can hear these talks live and in person every Tuesday night at our weekly Dharma gathering at 7 o'clock. And keep hearing enlightenment. Later. Mm-hmm.